From the studios of Central Coast Public Radio, KUSP in Santa Cruz, California, I'm Gary Shapiro, and this is From the Bookshelf. Donald Spoto is my guest this week, and it's always a pleasure to speak with him and to read his latest book. Fortunately, in addition to being one of our best biographers, Donald Spoto is also one of our most prolific. He has written biographies of Ingrid Bergman, Joan of Arc, Grace Kelly, Jacqueline Kennedy, Laurence Olivier, Audrey Hepburn, Alfred Hitchcock, and dozens more. His latest book is the sweeping saga of a great family of the British theater, The Redgraves, a family epic. Donald Spoto, welcome back to From the Bookshelf.
Thank you, Gary. It's a pleasure to speak with you.
Before we get to your new book, The Redgraves, a family epic, I have a few other things I want to discuss with you that have been on my mind lately. Your book, Spellbound by Beauty, Alfred Hitchcock and His Leading Ladies, was recently made into a film, at least a chapter of the book was made into a film, entitled The Girl, which told the story of Hitchcock and Tippi Hedren. Did you have any involvement with the film? Were you happy with the film?
Well, to answer the second part first, yes, I was not only happy, I was delighted with it. The fact of the matter is I had hoped it would be good. I dared not hope it would be brilliant in every way, which it is. Did I have any involvement with it? Yes, I'm credited on screen as a consultant. And from the start, they stayed in touch with me, they put questions to me, the screenwriter, the very, very excellent writer, Gwyneth Hughes, and the producer, Amanda Jenks, and I flew out to Los Angeles and spent a good bit of time with Tippi Hedren, who has been a very close friend of mine for 40 years. And we felt that that time with her was essential to tell the story, and I'm thrilled with it. And it's being shown for a whole month on HBO in the United States, and we'll have its European premiere in December.
It's an excellent film. I absolutely enjoyed it. How accurate a picture is it?
It's completely accurate. I mean, I was thrilled with the respect for history, the adherence to facts, not only the facts as Tippi Hedren herself has described them. First to me, I was the first one in whom she placed the confidence of telling this very difficult and complex story. And so yes, it's completely faithful to the facts, and it's also done. I'm about to use a phrase that is not particularly popular in our time, but it is done with exquisite good taste. There were opportunities for the director and the writer to go for the jugular vein, to do something a little bit vulgar, to push the envelope. They never did it. This is a movie made about adults, made by adults, and for adults, what can I say?
Well, you know, the phrase sexual harassment is like tossed around a lot now, but that really is just like a textbook example of sexual harassment, isn't it?
It really was a very, very sad and difficult time, a sad time in Alfred Hitchcock's life. And when people take liberties and when they overstep the bonds of the boundaries of professional decency, they make others happy, and essentially and fundamentally they make themselves even more unhappy. And it was a very sad and difficult life. Sexual obsession is a terrifying reality, and here was a young actress with no acting experience who was privileged to be cast as a leading role in the leading role in Hitchcock's film The Birds. And little did she know what she was getting in for, not only regarding the story and the difficulties of filmmaking, but also with Hitchcock's belief. And it's not uncommon in many other professions as well, his belief that fame and power gave him the right to control someone and to attempt, you know, sexual exploitation. He picked on the wrong person, however, because she wasn't about to go along with his demands. Well, but the movie is an extraordinary achievement in every way, and I must praise not only the director and the writer, but also the great Toby Jones for his recreation of Alfred Hitchcock on screen, and the brilliant and gifted and beautiful Sienna Miller, who played Tippi Hedren. So
she just becomes Tippi Hedren, doesn't she?
Yes, she's just wonderful.
Yeah. Well, you know, you had already written a couple of books about Hitchcock, and your first book was one of the great works on American film, The Art of Alfred Hitchcock. So in some ways, your career, you know, you owe your career to Hitchcock, and Hitchcock, you know, was an acquaintance, if not a friend of yours. And so does it, when you hear these things about him, you know, does it change your opinion of him? Does it alter your interpretation of his films?
It contributes to the fuller picture of a human being. I think when I was much younger, I started out as simply an acolyte, you know, just a fan who could spend a lot of time exploring the depths of these great films, to be sure. But I think, like many devotees, I was, shall we say, went a little too far in toward the canonization process. And as I found out the fuller truth of his life, it led me to explore the whole nature of creative genius and the isolation that geniuses often have in their lives. After all, the nature of genius is that these men and women are sort of placed at the margin of society, looking in. And that marginality, if you will, really isolates them. In the case of Hitchcock, we had a man who was desperately unhappy and lonely and friendless his entire life. That suffering enabled him to explore one of the social pathologies, or several of the social pathologies of our times. I mean, anyone familiar even vaguely with some of Hitchcock's pictures knows that they come from a very curious kind of interest in human nature, and one could not look at pictures like Strangers on a Train or Psycho and the Birds, and even going back to much, much earlier pictures, and say that these do not come from a man who was just a simple, you know, simple British burgher sitting at home and being comfy and chummy. He was a deeply, deeply repressed man until quite late in his life, and he his is a cautionary tale. It really is a cautionary tale. But I don't judge him. I don't judge anybody. But as a matter of fact, it deepens my sympathy for him, because he made no one unhappier than he made himself.
Well, along those lines, this year marks the 50th anniversary of the death of Marilyn Monroe, and you wrote a marvelous book about Monroe. I wonder if you have any thoughts about her.
Well, one always does. I mean, she's essentially a very sympathetic person. You know, here was a girl, Monroe was, who never knew her father, whose mother was mentally ill, who was exploited by a neighbor who wanted to turn this charming little child into the next Jean Harlow. I mean, she was grist for the devouring mills of Hollywood, wasn't she? But the fact of the matter is that it's amazing that she did anything with her life at all. I mean, primed as she was for disappointment and loneliness, she really did make something of herself, and she was a Kindernatur, as the Germans say. She was a child of nature, and she had a native intelligence that the people who knew her well, many of whom I met and interviewed, told me was astonishing. And she wanted to be well-read, she wanted to do good work, and she did good work. She was not just a dumb blonde, which Hollywood presumed was the limit of her talent. And Yes, I found her a very sympathetic person, and it was thrilling for me to write her biography, because I began with the, I suppose not the presumptions, but with the attitude that so many have even today, that she was an alcoholic, a drug addict, a woman of easy virtue who used sex to climb the ladder of Hollywood success. Well, none of these things are true. And the more I researched the story, and I was fortunate enough to have access to literally tens of thousands of documents that no one had ever seen before. And it made the fuller story, and I felt very honored to be able to tell it.
Well, her death was tragic, of course, and but it's been speculated about for 50 years. But I think your book tells us what really happened. What do you think really happened?
Well, it's not easy, Gary, to put it in a few words. It's, as you know, it's almost the last 100 pages of the book. Let's just say she didn't commit suicide. She wasn't murdered by any politicians or statesmen. Those were all fantasies created 10, 15, 20 years later. Her death was unnecessary and tragic, and she died at the hands of a manipulative person who probably didn't intend her death, but it was her psychiatrist. In fact, he was responsible apparently for the deaths of several famous Hollywood blondes. But Marilyn's was singularly tragic, and I just wish that the emphasis was thrown now and in the years to come more on her talent and her times than on her death. I mean, that really gets us nowhere.
You know, it's interesting because I think everybody, you know, young people today, they see a picture of Marilyn Monroe and they immediately go, oh, that's Marilyn Monroe. They know who she is, but probably haven't seen any of her films.
Yes. Well, you're right. You're right. And some of them are just extraordinary, achievements. Her performance in Bus Stop, for example, and in The Prince and the Showgirl, and in Don't Bother to Knock. I mean, she really was a significant talent. And they say she was always late and made people frustrated by her lateness. Well, they never complained about the fact that Spencer Tracy could be days late and would sometimes disappear and go off and get drunk for a week. Nobody ever said anything then, because when he came back, he gave a brilliant performance and made a movie. But it wasn't all right for a blonde woman to do that, you see.
Double standard there.
No, always, always.
Well, of course, Marilyn says it herself in character, in Gentlemen Prefer Blondes, when she said, I can be smart when I want to, but men don't like it when you're smart.
Oh, it's a good line to remember. Yes, you're quite right.
Well, we're talking with Donald Spoto, and he's one of the great biographers and film historians and theologians. And his new book is called The Redgraves, a family epic. It tells the story of Michael Redgrave and his acting offspring, including Vanessa and Lynn and Natasha and Julie Richardson. What drew you to this story?
What drew me to the story, Gary, were two things. First of all, I had the pleasure and privilege of knowing Michael Redgrave very well and his widow, the late Rachel Kempson Redgrave. And I knew them well and spent a lot of time with them. And after their deaths, their names kept coming up and their achievements kept coming up in other books that I had written. For example, my biography of Ingrid Bergman and my biography of Alan Bates and a number of others. Of course, the very first time I met Michael Redgrave was to interview him for my Hitchcock biography, because his first movie was The Lady Vanishes. And then it occurred to me about 5-7 years ago that although we have lives of John Gielgud and Laurence Olivier and Ralph Richardson and Alec Guinness, there's never been a biography of Michael Redgrave published in the United States. And this, it seems to me, was a dreadful gap. And because I knew him and because I had interviewed him and his wife and through them was able to contact the children, I thought this is a gap that has to be filled in. So it was thrilling for me, because there is no family like the Redgraves. As people of the theater, they started in the 18th century, and they're still going strong. So I felt that this family deserved, and all their papers are on deposit in London at the Victoria and Albert Museum. So it was thrilling for me to have access to that and to the many people who worked with them over the years. So it was a great privilege to do this book.
Well, it's a wonderful book, and one of the things I love about your books, when you write about Hollywood, you give a portrait of the Hollywood that these people were a part of, and here you give a wonderful picture of the British theater, and that's really enlightening. But there's also an aspect of this book that pervades the story, and that is a story of the injustice of a life lived in the shadows. Michael Redgrave was gay or bisexual, and he could never let this fact of his life be known.
Yes, it was particularly poignant and tragic, because before he married Rachel Kempson in 1935, he told her quite frankly that he didn't think marriage was a good idea. And she said that it didn't matter to her, and she felt, as she told me, that true love would change him. Well, this is a recipe for disaster. This has been attempted a number of times by a number of people. And on the one hand, one says it was tragic. On the other hand, they had a unique kind of relationship. They never divorced. And after all, the marriage gave them and us, three major people in the history of theater and film: Vanessa Redgrave, Karen Redgrave, and Lynn Redgrave. So I don't agree with people who say, oh, they never should have been married. I mean, that's just silly. But it led to a lot of personal unhappiness for both Michael and Rachel, his wife, a terrific amount of unhappiness, because, you know, try though they did to make the marriage work as a traditional marriage, they were both brilliantly creative and also in need of an enormous amount of affective affirmation, if you will. And Michael was terrified. Had it been revealed in the 1930s, 40s, 50s, 60s that he was gay, his career would have been over. His family would have been tainted forever. They would have been ruined. So there was, as you said, this terrible, you know, hiding in the shadows. The closet was a vault for people's feelings. And once again, I marvel that they did as much good work as they did.
And there is a lot of it. And some wonderful films that you tell us about. And I mean, it's such a... It's interesting because it's not just a book about Michael Redgrave, even though it feels like that for maybe the first half. And then you realize, oh, there's so much more and all these people, Vanessa and so forth. But I want to ask you, when you're writing about the lives of people, do you ever become... You said you didn't judge them a few minutes ago, but do you ever just get frustrated at missed opportunities or bad decisions or things like that?
Well, I guess I do. If you ask me to name the moments or the points in writing the story at which I felt those feelings, I'd have trouble doing it. I suppose I did, but I rack my brain to try to think of moments when I say, oh, come on, get on with it. I think probably, Gary, that what happens is that I've done so much work before I start writing chapter one. All the research is finished. The research takes most of the time. Mm-hmm. And I suppose that what all those feelings of perhaps impatience and with this or that person have already passed through the prism of my own understanding during the research, so that when I'm writing it, I can let them emerge without my writing on top of the story, if you will.
Yeah, yeah. Well, you know, we were talking a minute ago about the oppression of the lack of gay rights, I guess, for lack of a better way of putting it.
Mm-hmm.
And then with Vanessa, this Vanessa Redgrave, this terrible political blacklisting that happened to her.
Yes, it was completely unjust. Vanessa Redgrave should accurately be described as a humanitarian. Very early in her life, she was really an angry firebrand. But to be frank with you, the things she was angry about are the things that an awful lot of people were angry about. Nuclear proliferation, nuclear stockpiling, the disenfranchisement of people, of the poor, for example, at the cost of building militias by the great powers of the world. These were the things that led her to the barricades. These were the things that got her on marches. These were the things that got her arrested. And, you know, there's something heroic about her. When she was tagged as a political firebrand and unjustly termed an anti-Semite in the United States in the 1970s, and that was completely unjust. I mean, the idea of Vanessa Redgrave being anti any people, any race, any religion, is, it would be hilarious if it weren't pathetic, because all her life she's fought for all peoples to be free, and to just freedom is a great hallmark of her political and social creeds. When she was misrepresented by the American press, of course, was the night that she accepted her Oscar for the film Julia, her Best Supporting Actress Oscar. And she was pilloried in the American press for stating, and they said this, and it was not so, that the militant Palestinians were her heroes, and that they were fighting a war against Zionist hoodlums. Well, the people that she was proclaiming against were a fringe group of people who wanted simply to deny the Palestinian people any homeland, a belief that I don't think any sensible person maintains today. And she was completely misrepresented. And, you know, it did, as you said, it not only blacklisted her, it prevented her from working in the United States for decades. And this is a terrific injustice. Here was, my late friend, I shouldn't call him a friend, we only met a few times, but I knew him, Charlton Heston, whose politics were 180 degrees different from Vanessa Redgrave's. When she was blacklisted, when she was condemned erroneously, it was Heston who agreed with Vanessa about nothing. It was Heston who came to her defense and said the idea of blacklisting a talented person for any reason, especially a false one, is anathema, it's shameful. And I think these things need to be said.
Well, you also seem to have a special affection for Lynn Redgrave in your book. She was a wonderful actress, but there's something about the way you tell her story. She's particularly... shines in your mind?
Well, yes. I mean, they all do for different reasons, but Lynn had a lot working against her. As a child, she was asthmatic, and she had terrible problems with her weight, and she was physically frail despite the overweight, along with the overweight. And she had this older brother and sister who were already making their mark, you know, in their teenage years. And Lynn had a lot to live up to, in addition to, of course, having these two famous and accomplished parents. And she did remarkably well. I mean, after all, you look at her second picture, I think it was just her second or third picture, was Georgie Girl, and she was nominated for an Oscar. And from then on, she was very, very much in demand. I love to tell the story of the Vanessa and Lynn were both nominated for Best Actress of 1966. And Elizabeth Taylor won.
Mm-hmm.
I guess it wasn't 66, it was 67.
65?
Yeah, 60, yeah.
And I think Lynn was great in Georgie Girl. It's a great film. I also thought it was funny when you do occasionally, of course, give your opinion, because you know, how can you help it? But you said something about Blow Up being remarkably pretentious when viewed today.
I think it is. I mean, when we saw it back in 65, 66...
It was cool.
Antonioni's, oh my gosh, it was so cool. It was so mysterious. It was so... You look at it today and you say, huh? What's going on here? Antonioni was his most obscure, and I just don't think it works.
It's
a lot of the 60s films don't work, you know.
And that's interesting, because... in reading your book, I also went back and watched The Lady Vanishes, which is, of course, one of my favorite movies, and it's so great. It's absolutely still so fantastic. I mean,
well, I had that reaction about The Lady Vanishes 2 weeks ago. I addressed an audience at the Irish Film Institute in Dublin, and it was to present my new book on the Redgraves, and I chose The Lady Vanishes for a screening and lecture, because of course it was Michael Redgrave's first movie and the one that made him a worldwide, you know, celebrity, and it was also the film that put Hitchcock on the international map. And yes, the Lady Vanishes works today splendidly.
I was thinking of it It's a movie about a debonair, it's an espionage movie that features a debonair Englishman, sexy women, and ironic humor. Are we talking about James Bond? No, I'm talking about the Lady Bond.
Well, there was, you know, as Ian Fleming was the first to admit, there was nothing original about James Bond at all, you know.
Yeah.
But, I mean, Redgrave is charming in it. Margaret Lockwood, a name that many, many people do not recognize anymore.
She was beautiful, wasn't she?
She's absolutely stunning, and she's delightful in it. And, of course, that grandmotherly old, you know, Dame Mae Whitty as Miss Frawley. It just works. And the interesting thing about The Lady Vanishes, which many Hitchcock fans don't like to know, is that it's anomalous in Hitch's career. He usually was involved, as you know, in preparation of the script and every element from day one. He inherited this completely finished script and directed the film in just 3 weeks to fulfill a contract he had in London before going off to the David O. Selznick in Hollywood.
And yet it's still completely Hitchcockian, isn't it?
Yes, it is. It has the touches. And the writers of the screenplay, Launder and Gilead, were good at comic espionage thrillers, which was Hitch's stock in trade.
Well, we're talking with Donald Spoto, and he's one of the great biographers. His new book is called The Redgraves, A Family Epic. You know, the people have always said actors should be stupid, empty vessels, that intelligence and acting don't go together.
Yes, well, that, of course, is belied, particularly, and contradicted, if you will, particularly in the case of Michael Redgrave. Now, a lot of actors do avoid an intellectual approach to their craft because they don't want to be self-conscious about it, and that's a wise decision for them. Redgrave was an exception. He was a scholar. He had a graduate degree. He spoke 5 languages. He wrote novels and plays. He directed operas. He wrote books about the craft of acting and directing. He was a true intellectual. In addition to that, it didn't stymie his spontaneity or his creative instinct on the spot, on stage, on screen, on television. He was really an extraordinary person. And those who knew him well, and I really only got to know him in his last years when he was very ill but still very clear of mind, was his extraordinary intellectual life. And he never apologized for it, and he never tried to hide it. And it served him well, and it served the theater well. And if our listeners today, Gary, get hold of films like The Stars Look Down, or Morning Becomes Electra with Rosalind Russell, his performance as Orrin Manin, or even with a Fritz Lang picture that didn't particularly work, Secret Beyond the Door with Joan Bennett, He's simply amazing in it. And I really think that from his films, thank goodness we have so many of them, the Browning version may be the best of the lot, 1951. It got him the Best Actor Award at the Cannes Film Festival. It's simply a performance of staggering emotional depth. And because of these movies, we'll always have, you know, the ability to say, oh, you've never heard of a Michael Redgrave? Well, sit down tonight. You have a great pleasure in store for you.
The book is called The Redgraves, A Family Epic, and the author, Donald Spoto, one of the greats. And it's always such a pleasure to have you on the show. Thank you so much for being with us again on From the Bookshelf.
Well, thank you, Gary. I always enjoy our conversations.
That's it for this week's edition of From the Bookshelf. I hope you had a good time and that you'll come back and see us again next week. In the meantime, check out our podcast page at fromthebookshelf.com. Find us on Facebook and subscribe to the podcast at iTunes. I want to thank my guest, Donald Spoto. His latest book, The Redgraves, A Family Epic. From the Bookshelf is produced by Francis Venegas. And I'm Gary Shapiro. Thanks. See you next time.